The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
I'm going to tell you how this is going to go. Basically, we're going to talk about art in class, and I'm going to approach the subject through art, and Sarah's going to approach the subject through labor, and we're going to meet in the middle, and then presumably have an amazingly exciting discussion. So before I begin, I just say that my presentation is essentially going to be a criticism of how we use both the title words, art and class. That's what I'm going to pass through. And what I wanted to do is I'm going to go over some of the basics from my book about how I think a Marxist theory of class actually improves our understanding of what art is and how it works. So those of you who've read my book, I'm sorry if I bore you. And for those of you who haven't, you're welcome, because saving you the buy. But the art critic, British Marxist art critic John Berger once said that his love of art was unabashedly political, and he couldn't imagine it any other way. And that's kind of what I want people to take out of this talk, how Marxism, not just something that you add on top of liking art, but actually improves, it should improve how you like art, because the theory, if it doesn't, you've got the wrong Marxism. Because it's a theory of reality, how the world really works, so it should improve your understanding of what art really is and what the stakes of art are. That having been said, there are a lot of bad uses of Marxist rhetoric in art. There are a dime a dozen. I'll just give you what to me is an amusing example. Does anybody here know who the artist Jeff Koons is? Yeah. Raise your hand just so I know what kind of crowd I'm talking to. Probably the most famous American visual artist currently working, and is sort of known for making very large, shiny objects, like a sculpture of a balloon animal that sell for millions of dollars to rich people. And he just opened a large show at the Whitney Museum in New York, where I'm from, the largest show they've ever dedicated to an artist. And so I was researching the show and was amused to remember that in the 1980s, when he first started making art, actually the genre of art that people described it as was commodity art. And he made shiny objects that look like commodities, and the way critics talked about them is that this is a form of the critique of the commodity form, because he's making us think about what commodities are. He said, "I don't seek to make consumer icons, but to decode why and how consumer objects are glorified." That's how he talked about his art. There's kind of this Marxist rhetoric around it. And of course, now I think most of us in this room who know his work would think about him as like the ultimate glorifier of luxury objects. Actually taking the luxury object thing to a whole new, heretofore unknown plane. But I do think that, I believe that Marxism is really useful and actually helps us answer, to be corny, some of the really big questions like what is art? And last year, and I think we've been at this conference becoming slowly better about talking this, and last year I thought I came away with a lot of really interesting thoughts about this. Doug Singston, who's here, gave a talk last year about the British cultural thinker Raymond Williams, whose work, Literature and Revolution, you can and should pick up in the Haymarket Room. And I thought it was really good. And the concept I took away from that talk was Williams' idea of cultural materialism, that art isn't something that, you know, it's not a series of beautiful ideas that float around, but is a kinds of work, you know, a set of material things people do in different kinds of ways. And that may sound really basic, you know, a materialist approach to culture. But I came away from the conference thinking about it, and I was like, this explains so much. This explains why the conversation, I've been on tons of panels at this conference and other less political conferences about art and politics or art and class, and the conversation is always so confusing afterwards. Because you give a theory about art, and then you get to the question period, and people raise their hand, and someone's like, well, what about hip-hop? And then someone else raises their hand and says, well, what about quilting? And you realize that you thought you were talking about the same thing, but actually you're talking about a bunch of stuff that are very different kinds of creative labor, and you've sort of produced a category that holds them all together in a way that doesn't make a lot of sense. And something as basic as that, it's become what you'd call Marxist jargon, an idealist category. It's kind of been detached from the reality of what you're talking about. And it makes the conversation very confusing. And so there's been some good discussion since the last conversation via email from the people who are interested in culture about how to approach this and think a little more concretely about art. If you want to see some of the products of this discussion, I recommend you go to Grant Mandarino's talk tomorrow on photography, because it's the beginning of this idea of really looking at things a little more concretely. And so, having said that, I guess I should specify now what art means in the title of this talk, Art in Class, which is visual art. And I write my book is about visual art, the kind of art you see, that is the kind of art you see in museums and art galleries. And my argument about class, I think, is a contribution to a cultural materialist understanding of that field, but I think that field, part of my argument, is that it's a very quirky kind of, particularly quirky kind of labor. You know, visual art is a sphere dominated by like painters and sculptors and people who are a little more hard to define, but people who generally make their, you know, they have a creative idea, they implement it, and they figure out where that fits in the world, whether it goes in a museum or how to get someone to buy it. They have their own enterprise going, and that's actually kind of a weird, quirky thing. There are creative laborers who are a lot more quote-unquote proletarian, you know, who sell their labor really abstractly. You know, designers who they don't have the ultimate say about it. In some ways, it's interesting that we, as Marxists, you know, in some ways, design in politics is a more interesting question. Could be a more interesting question. Could be a really rich discussion, because that's how capitalism is putting creativity to work in a really direct way, where it's creative labor it's alienated creative labor in a very classical sense. Nevertheless, I think about class and visual arts, which I write about it, and so, which brings me to the second term in my title, which is class. And so now I'm going to take a little bit of time to talk about the basics of what I think a useful Marxist idea of class is and how it might apply to this to art. And I think that in general, this is a classic fuzzy concept, class. Again, where we think we know what we're talking about when we talk to each other. Even here, we're actually talking about a lot of different things, or a lot of things are lumped together. So one obvious way, thing that we mean by class is wealth, it's how much money someone has. It's obviously the 1%, that's obviously a really important use of the term, particularly in art. You know, there's obscene amounts of money and on view in the art world. It's important. It's important to think about that dimension of the world. There's another way that people talk about class, which is more cultural. You know, talk about middle class values or something, or middle class radicalism. And you're talking about, you know, like students. I'm talking about people who have a college education. So I'm talking about the way people present themselves, and that also is important in I think art, understanding some of the things that are messed up about the art world, the world that I look at, write about. You know, it's a very elitist world in a lot of ways. There's a lot of opaque jargon. It's deliberately, I'd argue, not very hospitable to people who aren't down already. You know, people whisper in museums, you know, because they feel like they're in the presence of something that they don't understand. You know, you're supposed to feel like you're eating your cultural spinach when you go to a museum. And that sense of class is important too, but there's a third one, there's a third sense of class that I really think is a unique Marxist contribution that gets talked about less. The labor sociologist Michael Zweig, who I quote in the book, says the working class does have different income, status, and lifestyles in the middle and capitalist classes, but if we leave the matter there, we miss the basic reasons classes exist in the first place. And what he's talking about is the idea of class as the kind of labor that you do and where it fits into the economy. And I think to think about this, why are Marxists fixated on the working class? What's the big deal? And because it's not just about how the poor working class, like they have it so hard. There are other, they're unemployed people, homeless people, students. There are other social groups you could look to if all you were thinking about is starting at the sticking up for the people at the bottom. The importance of the working class is that when it came into focus around the time Marx was writing, was this is new group of people that people had been, the economy had been dominated by shopkeepers and farmers, peasants and artisans, and there's this new kind of group of people who didn't make money off of the things that they owned. They didn't live by their own something that they owned. They were dispossessed. They sold their labor power in an abstract way to bosses who made their living by extracting profits from them. And that's a very interesting thing. That is a very interesting kind of social group because they have a very direct relationship to the bosses of society. The bosses can't exist without their labor, but at the same time, which is not, bosses can do fine without a small restaurant owner down the block or a shopkeeper. they can't do without the people who are working directly for them. And also the working class, because they're dispossessed, they're potentially more volatile, they can also potentially get rid of the bosses and then take charge of the key institutions of society and run them on their own. That's why the working class is an interesting thing to Marx, because it's a potential powerful group. It has a certain kind of social power, and in fact, a kind of social power that's defined against, one of the classical examples that it's defined against is artisans, right? Is people who have their own workshop kind of productions. And I'd argue that the contemporary artist, even though it's the contemporary artists are this weird kind of thing, it's an evolution out of that tradition of the artisanal tradition. People make unique objects that they uniquely crafted objects. Now there are wrinkles in that. There is a whole and important debate about the concept of the new middle classes, particularly in the 1980s. I'm working on a book about artisan gentrification, so I was reading the Marxist geographer Neil Smith, and he was talking about the debates around whether the new middle classes caused gentrification in the 1980s. And it's kind of like, yuppie professionals, essentially. So here's how he talked about it. Unlike the old middle classes of artisans, shopkeepers, small farmers, and self-employed professionals, the professional managerial class was not independent of the capital-labor relation, but was employed by capital for the purpose of controlling, managing, and administering to the working classes. So there are debates about what counts and how things count as middle class, but I still say that artists are actually a pretty classic example of someone who we Marxists define as a middle-class form of labor, the professional artist, that is. And even though I think in some ways it's counterintuitive, because we think of classes so much about wealth, about money, particularly in the case of artists, and how artists function in the world, is a really clarifying theory. Because it's confusing. One of the things that confuses the issue is that artists are poor, often very poor, struggling to make it, have very precarious lifestyles. The statistics, as far as anybody knows, say that artists, people pursuing artistic careers, are specifically poorer than people with who are similarly educated people. But at the same time, there's obviously a certain kind of privilege in pursuing the artistic lifestyle. It's a desirable lifestyle. Like, people bounce out of jobs that are well-paying in order to pursue the idea of having their own thing going. a certain kind of privilege there in having that backup. So I think you need something more than just the category of boss or worker in order to understand it. And I think the idea of this sort of other kind of way of relating to your labor helps explain some of the, I think, paradoxes, you know, of the way artists have radicalized. If you think about the cartoon, the stereotypical, if a radicalizing worker asks for more money, you know, they want a bigger cut, they want for what they do. Now, radicalizing artists, traditionally, the cartoon of it is people who reject money. I'm not selling out, you know, they want less, not more. Maybe they don't want less, but you know, the cartoon of the bad artist is the sellout, the person who does it for money. And so there's clearly two different ways of thinking about your labor there. And it relates, I argue, to a basic class position, right? Because money is what a worker gets for what they do. They don't get a say in how it looks. Whereas, you know, an artist has some measure of control over deciding what they create. There's a quote I use in the book from Lucie Lepard, who's the great socialist, feminist, Marxist critic who's writing in the 1960s, 1970s, 1980s. It's from The Pink Glass Swan. She describes the artistic temperament. She says, "Looking at and appreciating art in the 20th century has been understood as an instrument, or at best a result, of upward social mobility in which owning art is the ultimate step. Making art is at the bottom of the scale. This is the only legitimate reason to see artists as so many artists see themselves, as workers. At the same time, artists slash makers tend to feel misunderstood and, as creators, innately superior to the buyers slash owners. The innermost circle of the art world class system thereby replaces the rulers with the creators, and the contemporary artist in the big city, read New York, is a schizophrenic creature. She is persistently working up to be accepted, not only by other artists, but also by the hierarchy that exhibits, writes about, and buys her or his work. At the same time, she is often ideologically working down in an attempt to identify with the workers outside of the art context and to overthrow the rulers in the name of art." And to me, she doesn't say it, but she's describing that, the middle class character in the Marxist sense of the professional artist, that you're caught between these two. You're a boss, but you're your own boss. You're exploited, but you also exploit yourself. And so you have the category politically tends to be very volatile. And I think I'm going to end just with an actual example, which I think is very amusing to me and illuminating, and shows that I think in terms of thinking about art, the political possibilities of art, in a way that's really concrete, it really helps to have a category like the theory of class that I'm talking about. Art historian named Julia Bryan Wilson has this book called Art Workers. It's about the 1960s, 1970s, when, because of the general radicalism in society, artists were radicalizing themselves. There was a lot of, in New York, there was a lot of activism around, by artists, around the war, but also around artist issues. And one of the things that came out of that is this term people started to use, art worker, which is a kind of a hybrid term to identify. Artists were, you know, they were ripped off by museums, they weren't paid for their work, museums stole their work, and trying to identify that sense of exploitation. But at the same time, there was actually worker struggle all around, you know? So politicizing artists wanted to identify with this, so they came up with this category of art workers. There was a whole political formation called the Art Workers Coalition in New York that was politically interesting, really volatile, fell apart after a couple of years, but did interesting work. And so, in any case, Bryan Wilson talks about this artist named Robert Morris, who's a post-minimal sculptor. He's fairly famous, and in 1970 he had a show at the Whitney Museum, and he was very politically involved with artist activism in New York, and he was interested in like rethinking his art in solidarity with blue collar work, in a way, it inspires me because he was really trying really hard. He was trying so hard. So the name of the piece he did for the Whitney Museum was called Sight. And essentially, instead of having a show of sculptures, he said he was going to turn the museum into a construction site for the duration of the show.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.